Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 5th of July, recording at 7:35 p.m., and that's British Summer Time. Now, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes. But first, let's have a quick review of what's going on here right now. The big story today is that U.S. payrolls rose by 195, that's job creation, for the second consecutive month. And that was above the forecast of 165,000, average forecast. Now, that roiled stock markets in the Americas and Europe initially. Well, Europe stayed roiled, but Wall Street saw a turnaround, and that's interesting because what we saw initially in pre-market trading on Wall Street, we had gains, some decent gains, and then those were wiped out shortly after the U.S. Figures came out, and Wall Street was trading at a loss, and then it gradually picked up again. And currently, as I speak, obviously it's not at the end of the day yet, but we're up 0.9% on the Dow, and close to the same on the S&P and also the Nasdaq. Now, what we also know is that as these jobless figures continue to improve, that the Fed will be under additional pressure to commence QE tapering. Now, I say the Fed under additional pressure because a lot of people have been critical of the policy, particularly in recent months. So the best guess is that, assuming we don't have a dramatic deterioration in the employment figures or other economic data, that the first tapering will likely occur in September, although it could occur as early as the end of July, but that's generally not expected. Now, if Bernanke and his most likely successor, Janet Yellen, get their way, maybe it doesn't happen until later on in this year, but people will be watching for this, and it will remain an influence on market sentiment overall, a very important market influence. Now, let's step back a little bit, because during the last 4 years plus, now, Fuller Money's been generally bullish near the S&P lows, as you know, and as the archive will testify, well, crowd sentiment has been generally bearish near those lows. Currently, I believe that position is actually close to being reversed. In other words, crowd sentiment regarding Wall Street is now more bullish following the big run of over 4 years that we've seen to the upside. And Fuller Money is cautious, although we would not reduce positions in the performing autonomies, which Owen reviews so often, unless those shares, or as and when those shares clearly become overstretched, overextended relative to their rising 200-day moving averages. That does happen from time to time, and that's always the best time to take some profits in long positions, because those big overextensions relative to the moving averages will not be maintained. They will eventually revert back to the MAs and very often below them. Now, the main reason for our caution has been the strength of the rally since last November, which was overextended relative to its 200-day MA on Wall Street at the May high. Additionally, we're also seeing a spike in T-bond yields. Now, while this has led to a transfer of some funds from fixed interest to equities, rates are rising because the U.S. economy is doing somewhat better. Now, stock markets often provide their best returns following bear markets when valuations are cheap, because many people have already sold, and central banks are beginning to stimulate an economic recovery with their monetary easing policies. Looking ahead, the key point is that we're currently expecting a choppy ranging phase for equities over the medium term and possibly longer. I think it could be anything from 6 to 9 months to 2 or 3 years in an overall ranging phase where we might see some quite small bull and bear swings, but probably nothing too dramatic. Now, as I say, we do not envisage a bear market for the S&P 500 index, at least not one anything like the big slumps that we saw in 2000 and 2008. Nevertheless, risks are increasing somewhat, and a few of the leading high beta markets, they would include the Philippines, Mexico, Thailand. They've already fallen by 20% or very close to a decline of that extent from their highs this year. And for Thailand and the Philippines, I believe those highs were only back in May. They have rebounded somewhat, as you know, subsequently, but it has led to some deterioration in the overall pattern and signaled at least tops of near-term significance, and most likely medium-term significance. And we also need to bear in mind that mining shares remain in a bear market. Now, energy costs will obviously remain a hugely important influence for both for all stock markets, and that's always been the case. Those energy costs were gradually moving lower for much of the year, but they've been rising recently on some oil production cutbacks. Remember that? I think it was a month or two ago. And also, the political situation in Egypt, and that led to some long hedging in the markets. And although we've seen the Muslim Brotherhood government replaced, those positions, I thought we might see a fallback in the oil price following that, but it hasn't occurred. And actually, oil is quite strong in here today, up not that far off $2 per contract between the WTI and the Brent here today. Now, that's a concern. I don't think it's due to an increase in demand, but hedging has been a major factor in the past in driving oil prices to unsustainable levels. And that's a risk we don't want to see, or I certainly don't want to see. And if that were to happen here, that would add to disinflationary and deflationary pressures, which we're already seeing. Now, over the medium to longer term, I think energy prices are going to vary considerably among countries, and largely depending on their actual policies. For instance, the United States, as you know, has been a very aggressive producer of shale oil, and some other countries are trying to emulate that. China is very keen to produce some of its shale oil. I think we're also seeing it now in some Eastern European countries, I think particularly Poland. The UK, being impressed by the success that the US has had with its shale oil, is now moving in this direction, and it certainly needs to do so, and they've done so belatedly. But the situation in a good many other countries is less promising here overall. France, as you probably know, has actually banned any use of the fracking technology to generate shale oil and gas. Germany and some other countries, including the UK, went in for heavy building of windmills, very, very expensive and not all that popular now that people find them all over the place. And that has just driven up their energy costs overall. So while over the next decade or so, while this proliferation of other energy sources ought to be lowering energy prices in at least in real terms, if not also in nominal terms, I think we're going to see something that we have seldom seen, which will be quite a variation in energy costs among individual countries. And the U.S. is in the advantage position here right now and likely to hold on to that for quite some time. Now, looking further ahead for stock markets, assuming that energy prices are not going to spike higher, and I think that would be probably quite unlikely or very short-lived if it actually did happen for any reason. But looking towards the latter end of this decade, I think we will see evidence that global stock markets are moving from this choppy, rangy period that I've been talking about, that they will be moving into a bull market stage, and one that a new bull market stage, one I think will be the beginning of a secular, as in very long-term, bull market phase. Now, if this is true, I think the main drivers of this will be the accelerating rate of technological innovation, which I've mentioned so often. Cheaper energy would have to be there, and that would be another very important factor. And that forecast that I'm making is assuming that shale gas and oil production does become prolific over time, as more countries find that they really need to follow this route in terms of global competitiveness. And I also say other factors helping to create that next secular bull market in equities, which I expect would be the global dominance of capitalism and the rising middle classes that we see all over the world. Now, these are factors that just didn't exist when that last secular bull market was beginning, really from about 1982. Then we had a much smaller world in terms of the number of really vibrant capitalistic economies. I think we'll have much more over the next decade or more. Now, risks, there are always risks, aren't there? What could scupper that outlook for a secular bull market or punctuate it rather severely from time to time? Well, wars. We've always got wars going on, great or small, mostly small, and hopefully they will remain small, but that's a risk factor. A bigger risk, which I do take very seriously, is climate change. That's an unknown for us, and I think the evidence that we're in a period of climate change is pretty well obvious. And that's obviously going to cause some problems, hopefully not too serious, but we need luck, quite frankly. We need luck in terms of that climate change not being too traumatic and severe. And also, we need technological innovation to really help to reduce that risk over time. But it's going to be a factor for the rest of our lives to be justifiably concerned about. I think another problem is going to be unemployment, and that's really due more to the accelerated rate of technological innovation than anything else. And I think that the technologies will go on improving too quickly, not least in robotics which will be replacing more white-collar jobs, but also obviously blue-collar jobs, and that the innovation will be replacing jobs faster than new technologies can create additional unemployment. So I think these factors are all capable of contributing to disinflationary and actual deflationary pressures. Okay, moving on. Let's look at the bond sector, and the government bond sector in particular. Now, the big, huge bull trend in bonds really started to end, in my opinion, in late 2008 and early 2009. And actually, when I say in my opinion, I think the technical evidence, if you look at the charts for those bond yields, will bear that out. And after that, those low yields in 2008 and early 2009, we saw quite significant rallies. The bull market in bonds, in other words, lower yields, it got a lengthy second wind due to the quantitative easing, known generally as QE. Now, currently, bond yields are spiking higher in many countries. And today, for instance, on those employment figures, the U.S. 10-year yield, well, it's currently over 2.7. It's about 2.75, I believe, today. And the 30-year bond yield is a full point higher, and so up around the 3.6.5, 3.7 level. Now, remember that 10-year yield that I just mentioned of being over 2.7 today. That was actually down at 1.6, in other words, over a full point lower, 2 months ago. Now, some people say that the rally is overdone because it has spiked, these yields have spiked upwards. You can see that very clearly on the charts. My only comment is that, well, in a bull market, yield surprises are mainly to the downside. And we saw that occurring over a period of really over 30 years. So that was a big secular bull market in long-dated government bond. And in a bear market, surprises are really going to be to the upside for yields. So, you know, people can say, well, the move is overextended, and yes, it may be, but over the next few years and really over the next decade or more, I think we'll probably see more surprises in terms of yield moves to the upside than we will to the downside. And the only exception, or the only thing that could completely rule out that forecast, would be if we do not return to normal growth, sort of 6 to 10 years after the credit crisis. But if instead we see the sort of disinflationary and deflationary period for the whole global economy that Japan experienced, I don't think that's likely, but it's not impossible. And my feeling is that we are in the early stages of this bear market in these long-dated government bonds. Now, if the U.S. economy picks up just moderately over the next, or well, over the rest of this year, then those 10-year yields that I mentioned, currently at about 2.75, they can surge easily to 4%. And that level was last reached in 2009 and 2010. And as the U.S. economy continues to recover, I think it won't. Presumably, in 2014, and I think we will see those yields be pushing above at least 5%. So that's almost double what they are right now. Now, this is, I've just mentioned the U.S., but this can certainly affect sentiment in the other bond markets, as we've already seen, and as it will actually continue to do so over time. But the European bond yields, well, they mostly rose over fear, not over recovery prospects. And whereas the move that we're seeing upwards from some of those very low record levels that we saw in U.S. bond markets, in Australian bond markets, in New Zealand bond markets, in German bunds, moves are occurring because of the unwinding of some of those leveraged long positions that had occurred in those markets. Whereas, as I mentioned, in the broader European markets, particularly the southern European markets, just to repeat the point for emphasis, we had seen those yields rise due to scare factors. And although that is not the case today, Super Mario Draghi, the world's best central banker and most accomplished central banker, in my opinion, has been able to wring that speculation out of those markets, at least for the time being. Okay, what about currency markets here? But just to make sure we are in a bear market here in these long-dated government bonds in the U.S. and elsewhere, and I expect other markets to follow this trend over time. Now, currencies. The U.S. dollar, well, veteran subscribers will remember how the dollar fell for year after year after year, or fell for far more years than it was actually moving upwards. But today, we feel that the U.S. dollar is very much in the early stage of a bull market. Now, what would justify that bull market? Well, certainly the U.S. dollar fell to a very competitive level overall. But the additional changes that we've seen in recent years is the U.S.'s huge competitive advantage in terms of cheap energy costs due to its successful use of the fracking technology. And that's made it an enormous difference for the U.S. economy. It would be in trouble if it weren't for that fracking. And excuse me. And that invention, I think, has helped to stimulate the inventive instincts and capabilities of other people within the United States. You know, it's much the way if we talk about the hugely important game of cricket, and well, I'm sure you all follow cricket to a certain extent, even if you may not have played it. But you can have a batsman who's been a star performer from over the years, but can reach a slump, and he's not getting very many runs. But then he hits a century. That's 100 runs or more. And then his confidence surges, and he does well for a while. I think it's the same sort of psychology has helped to revitalize the to revitalize the U.S. In terms of its overall creativity. So these two factors helping to firm the U.S. dollar are very much the competitive energy advantages, and also a pickup in recent years in the inventiveness of the U.S. economy. And it's, I think, running ahead of competition, whereas a decade or more ago, 10 to 15 years ago, a lot of people were saying the U.S. was not creating enough new patents, the educational system wasn't good enough, that Asia was taking over in this direction. Well, we're seeing a U.S. resurgence, and that is also underpinning the U.S. dollar. Now, the Japanese yen's just the opposite story, because after being much too strong for much too long, the yen is now in a bear market, which the Shinzo Abe government has, he's the prime minister, of course, has actually introduced. And I think that this will definitely continue because although the yen has weakened very significantly since last November, if you look at the longer term charts, the yen strength went on for over 20 years, and that led to profound deflationary problems, as we were seeing. So I expect the yen to weaken further over the medium term. And incidentally, I don't think I repeated it earlier, this point earlier in my my broadcast, but Japan, among the major countries, remains, in my opinion, by far the most interesting bull market story, Japanese equities. Okay, now back to currencies. Here, China is currently keeping the renminbi strong, and it's part of the sort of restructuring, repositioning efforts that the new administration has undertaken. This is probably the most government-controlled rate, or certainly one of the most government-controlled rates that actually is. So the Xi Jinping and his followers clearly want a strong renminbi here right now. That will change inevitably at some point, just as we've seen the currency views change in other countries. Presumably, Xi Jinping wants to keep the inflation rate down, and we saw that strength in other currencies in Asia, really until in many other currencies, not all of them. But we saw that strength because they had inflationary pressures as well, which the currency strength helped them to control. And also they had some quite decent growth rates. But when Japan started to devalue the yen, these countries quickly, a number of them quickly felt that, well, they needed to move in the same direction, not to the same extent, but to reduce the pressure that expensive currencies were creating for them in terms of economic competition with Japan and other countries. So they're all being managed here, but when they're being managed less, the best tailwind to produce a firm currency is inevitably going to be economic growth. Now let's also take a look at the Australian dollar here, because again, veteran subscribers will remember all those years when Australians referred to their currency as the Pacific peso, disparaging comment, obviously. Now the Australian dollar ended that bear market and went into quite a significant bull market, really beginning in around 2001. But things have changed here more recently. One that throughout the last decade, a huge factor behind the Australian dollar was the strength of the resources bull market, largely due to demand for so many of these resources from China. So Australia benefited enormously from all the demand that was occurring in metals. And that included precious metals. But we know what's happened to that. So that bullish factor behind the Australian dollar is no longer there. Plus the fact that the Australians complained understandably about the strength of the Australian dollar, which was hurting the domestic economy, the non-resources portion of the economy. So now that commodities are moving in the opposite direction, Australia does not want to have a strong currency, and it started that weakening process, what was it, a couple of months ago, And I think that we will see a generally somewhat softer Australian dollar, at least over the next few months, or at least until those metal prices begin to pick up significantly once again. And there's no sign of that at the moment. As for other currencies, sterling and the euro in particular, they're likely to be kept relatively weak until their global GDP growth picks up. Let me say that again. Sterling and the euro will be kept weak until the economies in those regions begin to pick up. Now, moving on to commodities, precious metals, gold and silver are clearly in bear market trends here overall. But they're probably in the latter stages. It would be premature of me to call an end to the overall bear market decline because these things are still in clear downward trends characterized by lower rally highs. And those are quite pronounced, those trends. And until the progressions of lower rally highs are broken by a better rally following a period of stability, and then we begin to see some higher lows on reactions. Until that happens, the sell side will still be in charge, will still have the upper hand. And we have this selling pressure coming from stale bull positions in a lot of these tracker funds and ETFs. And they are still being reduced, so that's still out there. And then the short positions in these metals have been growing as well. So when most of that selling from the tracker funds and the ETFs is over, in other words, all the short to medium term and leveraged people have exited that market, and then that supply will begin to dry up, then you'll start to see some short covering, and that will produce some quite dramatic rallies in the precious metals. But we're not there yet. Okay, the palladium and platinum, particularly the palladium, are holding up better, although they are no longer really in overall upward trends or in declining trends. And this is largely due to expectations of shortages going forward, particularly, as I say, for the palladium. And what else can we mention here? The industrial metals are still weak. So this is a bear market environment for the likes of copper, aluminium, tin, nickel, zinc. And again, we don't have any clear evidence that those markets have bottomed yet. Most commodities are soft generally, grains and beans. Remember, it's almost in biblical fashion. We had the 7 years where adverse crop developments, not least drought being a big factor in various parts of the world, created havoc with the supplies, caused the surplus stockpiles that had been built up in previous years to be all but wiped out. Well, keep your fingers crossed. Touch wood. We're still in a year that looks like it could see some quite decent yields. Now, for that to take place, in the let's see, to just take the important the South American crop is largely in, and that was successful. But now in the U.S. Market overall, we had the late plantings, and we need to see favorable conditions, which is enough moisture, not heavy flooding, and a generally benign autumn as far as temperatures are concerned, so that they can bring in a late harvest in those countries. But food production is one of the areas that is most likely to be affected by climate change. So I think it's pretty difficult to make any long-term forecasts here, except to say that we can expect some weather-related turbulence. The volatility won't be caused by supply and demand factors. It'll be caused by changes in the outlook for crop cycles. And last but not least, we're back to crude oil, which I had mentioned much earlier on, was firmer here overall. And I'll just give you the prices that we see here late in this day on Friday. And the Brent crude oil price is up 192 to 107.46, and the WTI crude is up $1.78, and to that's at 103.02. Have a terrific weekend, folks. All the best.